Okay, hello everybody. Today I'm going to give the first of two lectures on the neoconservatives. What I'm going to be talking about today is mostly their views on domestic policy and the philosophical foundations of their view. They're best known, at least now, for their views on foreign policy, and I'm going to be covering that in the lecture next week. As I'll be mentioning in this lecture, when they got started, they weren't best known for their views on foreign policy. They started off more as primarily in domestic reform, although they always had foreign policy views. Now, what we've been talking about so far in the course, we first started off with talking about the old right, which is really a libertarian group, including Albert J. Nock and H. O. Mencken. And this group believed in the free market, and they favored a non-interventionist foreign policy. And during the 1930s, 1940s, they allied with this old right, allied writers such as Mencken and Nock, allied to some extent with the Republican Party. Previously, they'd been rather critical of people, or strongly critical, in fact, people like Herbert Hoover, but now they were united with him in the fight against the New Deal. Herbert Hoover, although, as Rockwood points out in Myth of the Great Depression, although he really had programs of his own that prefigured the New Deal, he thought the New Deal had gone too far and turned against it. And then also he was very much opposed to American entry into World War II, and he allied with the old right. But remember, after the war, when the Cold War started, there was a move in American conservatism that we were talking about in the last two lectures, the National Review conservatives. And the National Review conservative said, as far as the laissez-faire capitalism is concerned, they said, well, Buckley said, we have to suspend libertarianism for the duration of the Cold War. Cold War, we need a much more powerful government than was favored by the people on the old right. There were people like Frank Meyer, whom I didn't talk about all that much, but who tried to combine a basically libertarian outlook with a very aggressive Cold War policy. In fact, Meyer favored preventing nuclear war against the Russians, but that didn't work out too well. As we saw last time, there were very influential people in National Review like James Burnham and Wilmore Kendall, who were not just saying we have to suspend libertarianism for the duration, they were explicitly anti-libertarian. In Burnham's case, he believed in a kind of a managerial state run by a technocratic elite where power was the most important consideration and ethical principles or principles of right were really just viewed as ideological excrescences, as it were. And Wilmore Kendall was a follower of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. He believed in what he called the deliberate sense of the American community rather than individual rights. So those people made no pretense of being libertarians. Now, the National Review conservatives were in one respect similar to the old right in that they both tended to work through the Republican Party. The Republican Party was considered the more conservative of the two major parties. This hadn't always been true, in the late 19th century, especially under Grover Cleveland, the Democratic Party was a more laissez-faire party than the Republicans, but that wasn't the case, especially since FDR. The Democratic Party, although some people were conservatives in the Democratic Party, especially the ones from the southern states, the Democratic Party tended to be leftist in the modern sense. It was a left-wing party, at least more so the Republicans. So the conservatives we've talked about so far, both the old right people who allied with the Republicans and the National Review conservatives, tended to the extent they considered themselves allied with a political party to view themselves as Republicans rather than Democrats. Now, the group we'll be talking today didn't do that. They started off as Democrats. To understand what was happening with them, we have to realize they were a separate group from the National Review conservatives. They agree with the National Review conservatives in rejecting laissez-faire and also rejecting non-interventionism. In fact, they went further than National Review conservatives on rejecting laissez-faire. There were some people, especially like Frank Meyer and other people, who were writing for National Review, at least in the early days, included Henry Hazlitt and Murray Rothbard, who were strong supporters of free market. But the group we'll be talking about today did not have people who were very strongly free market people. So see, they weren't socialists either, but they were tend to be more interventionist than the National Review conservatives. But the basic point to remember that I've already alluded to is that the neoconservatives were not allied with the Republican Party. They began among liberal Democrats. So we have to ask, well, how did we get, we have an apparent problem here. We're starting off with liberal Democrats, and we're supposed to get neoconservatives out of it. So how do you get some kind of conservatives out of liberal Democrats? It seems like you'd be getting into some sort of contradiction there, at least tension. How would this take place? So to understand what happened, during the late 1960s, what we could call the Cold War consensus was breaking down. And this consensus had appealed to many Democrats, beginning with Truman. Remember, Truman was president right after Franklin Roosevelt died in February 1945, and he was elected to a term in his own right in 1948. Defeating the Republican candidate Thomas Dewey. So with Truman, there was a certain consensus that developed, and a lot of Democrats agreed with that. Now, what was involved in this consensus? What were the Democrats under Truman agreeing on? Well, first of all, they accepted Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. They were not at all sympathetic to those people who said, like the people on the old right, who said FDR's New Deal is a type of fascism, this is dangerous. They wouldn't have liked John T. Flynn at all. They would say, no, the New Deal is great. In fact, Truman had his proposal, which he called the Fair Deal, which was an attempt to extend the New Deal. Although it was an extension, but it wasn't something that was much more radical than the New Deal. It wasn't as radical a break with past American history as the New Deal had been from previous regimes. It wasn't radically extending the New Deal. It was saying, basically, the New Deal is a good thing. We've got to increase it somewhat, but things were pretty good with the New Deal. It isn't that we need some kind of really fuller type of socialism we had under Roosevelt. What Roosevelt was doing was just fine. Now, in foreign policy, the Truman Democrats, who were starting this Cold War, I call it the Cold War consensus, favored a very active pursuit of the Cold War. They thought that the Soviets had been allied with the U.S. Remember, the Soviets at first had started off signing a non-aggression pact with the Nazis, August 23rd, 1939. But this ended when the Germans invaded Russia June 22nd, 1941. And after that, when the U.S. entered the war in December 1941, the U.S. and Russia were allied. So during World War II, Russia and the U.S. were fighting on the same side, and Franklin Roosevelt had been quite favorable to the Soviets. He got along fairly well with Stalin, and he was hoping that they'd be able to get along after the war. But Truman was more anti-Soviet than FDR had been. Truman had the view that the Russians were seeking to expand in Europe, and it was necessary to block them. He agreed, remember last week we were talking about the containment policy that George Kennan had formulated, and Dean Acheson, who was one of Truman's secretaries of state, he was very much in favor of containment. We had Truman had policies like aid to Greece and Turkey. This was Truman doctrine that the U.S. would give aid to any country that was facing the overthrow of its government by the communists. The U.S. would very actively pursue the Cold War. So when Truman had these Cold War policies, there were some people on the left who were opposed to this. Some people said, no, we got along very well with the Soviets in World War II. We shouldn't have this aggressive policy against them. We should try to get along with them better. And the leader of those people, that faction of the Democratic Party, was Henry Wallace, who had been first Secretary of Agriculture under Roosevelt, and then he had been Roosevelt's vice president in the 1940 election. Can anybody tell me, incidentally, who was Roosevelt's vice president in his first two terms? Does anybody know that? John Nance, let's see who said that. John Nance Gorney, that's correct. Actually, John Nance Gorney lived to a tremendously old age. I think he died in his late 90s. He outlived all these other people. So he was dropped in 1940 because I think he didn't really like the New Deal and he wanted to run against Roosevelt and didn't agree with Roosevelt's third term. They put Henry Wallace on the ticket, but Roosevelt, under pressure from people in the party who thought Wallace was too left-wing, he was dropped, and Harry Truman became the vice presidential nominee in 1944, and then when Roosevelt died, that made Truman the president. But Henry Wallace led a group called the Progressive Party, which is not to be confused with the Theodore Roosevelt progressives, but they ran against Truman Wallace ran for president in 1948, and he was favorable to a more pro policy, trying to get along with the Soviets more, and there's quite a bit of evidence that the communists backed Henry Wallace. He was sort of the communist supported candidate, but he didn't do very well. Truman won the election. So the Cold War consensus was saying Wallace was wrong, that we have to pursue the Cold War, but at the same time not abandon the New Deal and try to extend that. Now, very important presentation of this point of view was in a book, came out in 1949, by Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who was a historian at Harvard. Schlesinger had written, when he was quite a young man, very young, influential essay, book on Andrew Jackson that Murray Rothbard thought was all wrong and tried to refute. And he had written, he later went on to write a massive biography of Franklin Roosevelt. But in his book, The Vital Center, Schlesinger defended an interventionist American state, that's a state that, I mean, here I'm using interventionist in the economic sense, meaning a state as opposed to a laissez-faire capitalist regime, which would be one such as the New Deal, where the state intervenes actively in the economy. And Schlesinger said that he thought that an interventionist American state would be ideally suited to wage a battle against fascism and communism. So he wasn't saying Vital Center wasn't the middle of the road, kind of exact middle. It was more, this would be kind of the center of action. This would be, if you had the state like the U.S., as it was under Roosevelt and Truman, was really the best possible system. It wasn't that socialism or communism was the best system, and on the other hand, it wasn't laissez-faire capitalism was the best system. This FDR-type, Truman-type system was the best one. And Schlesinger said, well, this isn't such a radical policy. In fact, a true conservative would be someone who favors conserving the gains of the New Deal. So he's trying to appropriate the term conservative for proponents of the New Deal. Now, this view is Cold War consensus really was the dominant view beginning in the late 40s, going through the 1950s and into the 1960s. But by the late 60s, this Cold War consensus wasn't working very well. Now what happened? Well, the most important thing was the Vietnam War. Remember, the U.S. intervened very massively, especially under Lyndon Johnson, to try to prevent the South Vietnamese government from falling to the North Vietnamese communists. The Vietnam War led to about 58,000 American deaths, which is enormously more, say, than deaths were lost in the current wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So this was, I remember this very well when I was in going to UCLA at the time. Students were very concerned about the draft, which we had at that time, and it was a very major event that people were very concerned that all these lives are being lost. And the question that a lot of people had was, well, what was the U.S. national interest in defending South Vietnam from North Vietnamese communists? Very few people wanted the North Vietnamese communists to take over, but the question came up, well, should we be willing to spend so many lives, American lives, to prevent this? What is so vital about defending South Vietnam? Of course, you could ask the same question about the Korean War in the early 1950s, but at that time, there wasn't as much opposition to the war in the U.S. Now people were more sick of the Cold War. In the Vietnam War, people started protesting. They wanted to know what it was for. And the war, especially since, yes, after the Tet Offensive in 1968 by the North Vietnamese, wasn't going that well for the U.S., so people were very upset about it. And what the people would usually be told, the defenders of the war said, well, if we get out of Vietnam, then we'll lose credibility. America has promised various countries will aid them under certain conditions, and our allies, in order to for America to be a powerful country, have to believe that the U.S. is going to come to their aid. But if we say, well, this is too costly in Vietnam, or we're not going to, we don't want to get involved anymore, then people won't believe our commitments anymore and will lose credibility. Many people say, well, is it really, should we really send all these soldiers to die just to have some increase, possibly, in American credibility? People tended not to buy the argument that much. So the criticism of American foreign policy became very strong, and some people went much further than what I've just said. What I've said so far is some people were saying, well, granted, we don't want the communists to win in Vietnam, but maybe it's not really worth preserving Vietnam to lose all these American lives. Maybe we're putting too much emphasis on whatever loss of credibility would result from withdrawal. So this is kind of a criticism that's really accepting the basic premises of American policy, saying, well, you know, we do want to contain the communists and we want to have a credible American policy, but maybe we just put too much into this particular war. Maybe we just made a mistake about it. But some people went much further and said, why do we have to have a Cold War policy altogether? The whole American state is radically wrong. And there were groups like the SDS, the Students for Democratic Society, that called for revolutionary change in American society. And in 1968, at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, there were riots, and the mayor at that time, Richard Daley, called the police, and a lot of the rioters were beaten up, and it aroused a lot of popular protest. So people were not just questioning the Cold War consensus on points of strategy and accepting the basic premises. There were some people saying, we've got to really throw over completely the basis of American foreign policy. Now, these groups at first were just protest groups that could be considered outside the mainstream. But in 1972, the Democrats nominated George McGovern, who strongly criticized American foreign policy. Incidentally, if you look at McGovern, he had been, in 1948, he had been a supporter of Henry Wallace. Remember, who was the person who was saying Truman has made a mistake in having this vigorous policy opposing Russia. We should try to get along with Russia. So McGovern had been a Wallace supporter, and he was now saying we should withdraw from Vietnam completely. We should cut defense spending by 37%, I think, in 3 years. So to some extent, sort of a much more radical figure, at least temporarily, taken over the Democratic Party. Of course, he lost to Richard Nixon, but he had this more radical group had taken over the party. Now, there were some Democrats who didn't like the McGovern movement. These people said that they thought the Cold War consensus is really right. There may be some problems, they may have made some mistakes in Vietnam, but this didn't mean they said that there was something fundamentally wrong with the way America had been operating since the time of Truman. Truman's policies, which had continued under down to Lyndon Johnson, were basically going along the right track. Now, a number of these people were associated with Senator Henry Jackson in Washington, who was nicknamed Scoop Jackson. I don't know why he's always called Scoop Jackson. I guess maybe he thought that would make him popular if he had a nickname like that. You know, it would be funny if you imagine names of different statesmen like Benny Mussolini or Frankie Roosevelt. Somehow it doesn't sound all that right, but they always call Jackson Scoop Jackson. And Jackson fitted in exactly with what I call the Cold War consensus. He supported the New Deal, and at the same time he favored a strongly anti-Soviet foreign policy. And two people we'll be mentioning next time, Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Pearl, who were very actively involved in the planning for the Iraq War, worked up as aides to Senator Jackson. And again, another thing that's very important in, again, this will be, we'll be giving this next time and this time, but it's very important to understand this because it's one of the bases of the neoconservative movement. Jackson was very strongly pro-Israel in his foreign policy. He thought that support for Israel is really a linchpin of American foreign policy. He very much favored aid to Israel and taking the Israeli side in the disputes between Israel and the various Arab countries. Now, there were a group of New York intellectuals who became associated with the critics of Democratic Party radicalism. So these people we're talking about now were ones who said, we don't like this McGovernite movement or all these moves to say we've got to overthrow the Cold War consensus. We like the way things were under Truman. This was really, things were going along pretty well. And three people in particular I want to talk about, the three most important of the original neoconservatives were, and these are all from New York, were Irving Kristol, Nathan Glaser, and Daniel Bell. And they all grown up in New York, and they all went to City College of New York in the late 1930s. Now, one reason a lot of people went to City College was it was a very good school, and I think they charged very little in the way of tuition. Anyone could get into it. It was very easy to get into it. It was a very good school. But so they all went there, and when they were students, they were all Trotskyites, followers of Leon Trotsky, the Russian communist who quarreled with Stalin and thought that Stalin had not been revolutionary enough. Now you'll notice a kind of interesting parallel here. These three neocons start off as Trotskyites. And you remember in the National Review group, they also had people who were Trotskyites. James Burnham and Wilmore Kendall whom we talked about last time were also Trotskyites. So if I wanted to be nasty, which of course I never am, we could call this course the old right versus the ex-Trotskyites. So we have ex-Trotskyites who are now eventually lining up as conservatives, which is a bit odd to say the least. Now, Nathan Glaser and Daniel Bell both became sociologists. They started off as journalists, and I think Bell, for example, wrote for Fortune magazine and another magazine called The New Leader, and Glaser wrote articles for Commentary, and they were tend to be associated with as intellectuals attached to various American labor unions. But both ended up teaching sociology at Harvard. Of the three, incidentally, Crystal, Glaser, and Bell, only Glaser is still living. I think Crystal died at around age 89. Bell, I think, lived to also a very old age. But Glaser is still around. I think he was born around in the 1920s, and he's still around. Now, both Glaser and Bell were more interested in domestic policy than in foreign policy. Remember, I mentioned today the neoconservatives tend to be known more for their foreign policy. People say, well, and we'll examine this next year, say they're the ones who got us into war with Iraq. But Glaser and Bell were more interested in domestic policy. Now, they didn't reject the Great Society programs of LBJ entirely. To the contrary, both Glaser and Bell were democratic socialists, at least. It's more clear that Bell retained those views and Glaser, but I think both could still be considered democratic socialists. But they argued that many of the Great Society programs weren't working very well. So they weren't, as libertarians would, they wouldn't say, well, these programs, such as the war on poverty, aren't very good because they're interfering with people's property rights. They would say, no, they're just problems with the way these programs have been implemented. And Glaser and Bell's basic criticism of Great Society programs was that these programs didn't address the fundamental problems of character among the poor. Say what the war on poverty would say, well, we've got it, people are poor, we've got to give them more money. But according to Glaser and Bell, people are poor, at least to a large extent, because they have certain habits, certain ways of living that will lead them to not be able to support themselves adequately. And the Great Society programs didn't really address those programs. And in particular, and this is one that Glaser wrote about, and Daniel Moynihan, who I didn't mention, another person who actually collaborated with Glaser in writing about this particular problem, that among American blacks, there tended to be a lack of two-parent families. According to Glaser, if you have families where they're both the mother and father present bringing up the children, the children tend to turn out with better work habits and they're more responsible. But among American blacks, there were a very high percent of cases where there weren't two-parent families. A lot of cases, there'd be the mother or another female, like the grandmother would be raising the children. And there were also very high rates of out-of-wedlock births. So Glaser was saying, Bell was saying, the Great Society isn't really addressing these fundamental problems of character. Now, Bell extended, tended to look at things kind of from a wider perspective. And he argued that capitalism is a self-undermining system in the sense that it leads people to pleasure-seeking, if you will. That under capitalist system, you'll get more money than under other economic systems. Then people will tend to use this money and spend it on all sorts of consumer goods, like fancy television sets or fancy computers, and always spend money on personal things. And capitalism depends on hard work and people who are enterprising, people who are able to come up with new ideas. But Bell thought that instead of, after a while, because people get to be rich, so the riches will corrupt them, and then they'll be just concerned with their own personal pleasures, or at least more than they were before, and they won't be have the virtues that are necessary for a capitalist system to function. So he thought capitalism would tend to undermine itself. Now, both Bell and Glaser wrote for a magazine called The Public Interest, which I think Irving Kristol was one of the founders of that, along with Bell. And this magazine attracted a lot of interest because they, if you compare it, say, with National Review, in National Review there'd be criticisms of the Great Society, but they wouldn't be, they would just appeal to people who already accepted the standpoint of National Review. It would be kind of ideological articles. The Public Interest had a lot of very careful empirical studies, so people who wrote for that magazine wouldn't just say such and such a Great Society program isn't working because it violates our philosophical principles. They would say, we have results, we have studies that show this program isn't working well. So that attracted a lot of people's attention. Now, neither Bell nor Glaser ever really changed from being liberal Democrats. They were just saying, well, it isn't that we're opposed to aiding the poor at all, we just think that these particular programs aren't working so well. So even though they were there at the start of the neoconservative movement, they eventually faded out of the movement. They weren't the ones, they were, they had mentioned Kristol, Bell, and Glaser kind of important right at the start. After a while, it was Kristol was the one who was left. He had a different path. So he was really, at least to be early neoconservative movement, Irving Kristol was the most important person. And after World War II, Kristol was associated with an anti-communist group called the Congress for Cultural Freedom. This is sort of a group trying to get American and European intellectuals involved in writing against communism. I don't know if you, this is, I'm sure you're not, most of you aren't old enough to remember this, but there's a book published called The God That Failed, I'm not referring to the subtitle of Hans Hoppe's book, but remember, Hans had a book called Democracy, The God That Failed. Well, where do you get the title, The God That Failed? That was from a famous book that came out, which had testimonies by various people who had been in the Communist Party or associated with close to it. He said, communism was all wrong, we made a big mistake. So that was an example of something that this Congress for Cultural Freedom was behind, so Crystal was involved with that. He also worked for a magazine in London, published in London, called Encounter, which again had articles by, it was a very good magazine, had good articles in it, but they were written from a point of view, sort of very anti-communist point of view. In both the Congress for Cultural Freedom and Encounter magazine received funding from the CIA. So again, we see a parallel between the neoconservatives and the National Review Conservatives. Remember, Burnham and Kendall were both associated, and Buckley were associated with CIA, and Crystal also was getting funding from the CIA. So again, there's a CIA connection. Now, how does Crystal differ from Glaser and Bell? Remember I said Glaser and Bell were, start off as critical of the Great Society, but they still remain liberal Democrats. Now, like Glaser and Bell, Crystal criticized the Great Society for its lack of stress on virtuous habits. He said, well, it's important that the poor people develop the virtues of hard work, being responsible for what they do, and the Great Society doesn't really know how to do that. But this is how he differed from Glaser and Bell. After the Democratic Party really didn't go the way he wanted, Democratic Party really didn't take his suggestions that much. He allied with the Reagan presidency, and then he became close to the National Review conservatives. Crystal was really one, also this is somewhat unusual for neoconservatives, he was willing to consider himself a neoconservative. Most neoconservatives kind of tend to avoid the term, but he considered himself that. But he tended to stress that neoconservative was more of a style of thought rather than an explicit body of doctrine. And what I'm going to try to show, though, is that this is somewhat, or quite a bit, misleading, because he did have definite ideas. It wasn't just kind of a style of thought, meaning kind of a characteristic way of approaching things, like maybe, say, if you have a style of thought, maybe cite certain types of authors, or use certain kinds of arguments, maybe say somebody could talk about somebody having a philosophical style or an empirical style of thought. But in fact, Crystal had definite ideas. Now, one of these ideas, again, this is again along the lines we've already talked about with Glaser and Bell, he says that the idea of a welfare state is in itself perfectly consistent with a conservative political philosophy, as Bismarck knew 100 years ago. So he's definitely not one of the libertarians who's saying we don't want a welfare state. He's in favor of a welfare state, but that isn't so unusual. But what is unusual is, and this would be something that might be even unusual for the National Review people, he's saying something favorable about Bismarck. Bismarck was someone who isn't exactly an American hero. He's viewed kind of as an authoritarian, by most people as an authoritarian figure of European conservatism. But Crystal cites him as if having Bismarck on your side is really a good thing. So this shows he's tending to ally in, at least in this respect, with a figure of the European right. So he's basically, he's a Truman style Democrat, start off as a true style Democrat, but he's saying really that you can favor that policy, but you can still be sympathetic to Bismarck. Now, Crystal is very much influenced by a book we talked about in one of the earlier lectures, Herbert Croly's The Promise of American Life. And you remember this book, Croly was the founder of the New Republic magazine, and Croly calls for a new American nationalism. He was Theodore Roosevelt was one very much along the lines that Croly liked. In Croly's view, which Crystal agreed with, the role of the government was to guide the people. Remember, mentioned already, Crystal was criticizing Great Society for not stressing that the people need, especially the poor, need to develop the various virtues. So Crystal didn't just apply this to the poor. He thought that the role of the government is really to guide the people. This is, I think, one reason he was sympathetic to Bismarck, because Bismarck had that new kind of government is really over the people. It's supposed to tell them what to do. Now, Crystal had very little use for individual rights taken apart from public duty. So he wouldn't agree, say, with Rothbard or Hans Hoppe that people have rights based on self-ownership. He wouldn't deny people have rights, but he'd say these just go along with various public duties. And when he wrote about the American Revolution, he didn't agree with the view that Rothbard held, that the American Revolution was a radical assertion of human rights. You can see the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are endowed with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Crystal wouldn't stress that at all. He'd stress more that there were particular grievances against the British. And in fact, at one conference, he got into a big argument with Bill Marina, who was a libertarian historian who died a few years ago, and they got into a big argument on the American Revolution just on that point. Now, Crystal was not a socialist. He opposed socialism. And he had one argument, I think is quite an interesting one, against egalitarian policy. He said, well, the various people say that equality is desirable, but very few people favor absolute equality. George Bernard Shaw was one who thought the Irish playwright was one who thought everybody should get the same income. But most people, even socialists, don't say that. They just say, we should have more equality than we do now. But Crystal said, well, if we say equality is desirable, how much equality should we have? And people don't really specify that, so they don't really give a clear criteria. So this, I think, is a quite reasonable argument against egalitarianism. But the fact that Crystal endorses this by no means indicated he supported unrestricted capitalism. In fact, he criticized capitalism along the lines I've already mentioned, leading to selfishness, and he thought that capitalism had to be guided by the state. Crystal was primarily a writer on domestic policy to the extent he wrote on policy issues. Many of his essays, he did write a lot on policy, but many of his essays were broader, more themes in the history of ideas. He would write about people like Herbert Croly or various ideas that he was interested in. He was more of an intellectual historian. In fact, his wife, Gertrude Himmelfarb, who's still living, was a leading intellectual historian. She's one of the great authorities on Victorian Britain, and she did a very good essay on Jeremy Bentham's Panopticon project. She wrote a biography of the Lord Acton. She's one of the top intellectual historians. But although he wrote primarily on domestic policy, we can see from his approval of Herbert Croly and the New Nationalism, you see his willingness to support an aggressive foreign policy. And as we'll see next time, the concentration on foreign policy became much more important for later neoconservatives like William Crystal, who's Irving Crystal's son, who is the editor of a magazine, The Weekly Standard, which is one of the leading neoconservative publications. Now, I mentioned that Crystal said that neoconservatism wasn't a fixed philosophy, but more of a style of thought. But there's a book I want to mention, I recommend this to everyone, by C. Bradley Thompson, called Neoconservatism, an Obituary for an Idea. And he presented a strong argument that Crystal's views and neoconservatism generally did have a philosophical source. So what Bradley's doing, see, Bradley is an objectivist, and the objectivists believe that philosophical ideas are really the motor of history. And if they're studying a historical movement or some political movement, they'll try to get what are the underlying philosophical ideas. Remembering the famous book, Ominous Parallels by Leonard Peikoff, Peikoff tries to trace the Nazis to Immanuel Kant's philosophy. I don't think Peikoff brought off his project very well, but I think Thompson does succeed, I think, to a large extent. Thompson at work, he does show that Leo Strauss's ideas were very influential on Crystal, and they help us understand the neoconservative movement. And Crystal said that reading Leo Strauss was the most important intellectual event of his life. Now, one thing Thompson doesn't mention that supports his view is that Milton Himmelfarb, who was Crystal's brother-in-law, his Gertrude Himmelfarb's sister, wrote about Strauss in mostly in commentary magazine. He showed a quite detailed knowledge of Strauss's work. Now, so according to this view, Thompson, Strauss is really the philosophical basis, Strauss's view is the philosophical basis of the neoconservatives. But we've got a problem is that how to interpret Strauss is very controversial. There isn't kind of a single way of looking at Strauss that everybody accepts. But one way to take him, this is the way Thompson takes him, is that Strauss thought that people have to be guided by a philosophical elite. It's really a philosophical elite that should be running society. And if you're familiar with Plato's Republic, you'll see really the same notion that the guardian is kind of the philosopher, really kind of the philosopher kings who are in charge. And on this way of looking at Strauss held it. Compared to philosophers who were concerned with the great questions of existence, what is the nature of existence, what are the essences of things, the masses who aren't interested in philosophical questions aren't really human beings. It's really the philosophers who are the true human beings. And because the masses are so much beneath the philosophy, it's justifiable to deceive the masses. We get Strauss mentioned, remember, in the Republic, we have the noble lie in the Republic where people who end up in the public in inferior positions who are not the rulers, are told a story about how they kind of originated from kind of the baser metals. They're kind of derived in some way from baser metals that was somehow involved in there when they were being conceived. And so this is all made up, but it's just to deceive the masses so they'll accept their inferior place. Now, you might object, those of you who read Rothbard might object, well, doesn't Rothbard and Ethics of Liberty speak rather favorably of Strauss's argument for natural law? Strauss argued favor natural law. But this is inconsistent with what I suggested, this view of Strauss, because then we would have the question, what is the content of natural law? And Strauss could have held that the content of natural law is that the masses are supposed to be ruled by the philosophers. Now, one asks, well, why is it that the public have to be guided by the philosophers? Well, we have the general point that the masses are inferior. There's an additional point that enters the scene with the rise of capitalism. And this one we've already mentioned is one that Strauss held, but this is one we've already mentioned certainly the neoconservatives like Crystal and Bell held, that capitalism encourages each person to think of his own material interests above all else, and acquisitiveness, getting as much as you can for yourself, accumulating money, becomes the primary virtue. Remember Marx said in Das Kapital, when he's talking about the Catholics, that accumulate, accumulate, that is Moses and the prophet. So on this view of capitalism, Marx was right, that is what capitalism tends to inculcate in people, trying to acquire as much as possible. So a philosophical elite has to counter this and try to prevent people from being dominated completely by the pursuit of self-interest. And Strauss took a very negative view of John Locke, who's the great supporter of self-ownership and acquisition of individual property. Strauss saw Locke as basically a Hobbesian. He thought that Locke really didn't differ all that much from Hobbes, although he seemed like he did on the surface, and he really didn't. And instead of seeing Locke as a supporter of natural rights, in the way that, say, we understand this in libertarians look at Locke, as someone said, well, people have a right of self-ownership, right to acquire property. He said Locke is basically preaching acquisitiveness as the primary virtue, and that he was in essence a utilitarian. So he downplays Locke's approval of natural right. I think it's interesting that Strauss was a friend of the British socialist historian R.H. Tawney, Richard Henry Tawney, who sponsored his academic career in England. Strauss was born in Germany, but he left Germany when Hitler came to power. I think he saw that there would be no place for him in Germany. He went to England. And Tawney, and I think Strauss has gotten his view of capitalism to a large extent from Tawney, Tawney condemned capitalism for being acquisitive. He wrote a book called The Acquisitive Society. That's the American title book. In England, the title is The Sickness of the Acquisitive Society. And Tawney thought in the Middle Ages it was a more harmonious society. People tended to care about one another and everyone had a place in the world. But capitalism changed all this and people were kind of narrow and self-seeking. And Strauss really took this over from Tony, I think. Now, although Strauss thought that the philosophical life was the highest possible life, he also thought that great power politics had value. So he's saying, well, if you can't be a philosopher, at least if you're a statesman in pursuit of power, this is also a very valuable activity. And he's gotten this in part from Plato. And he was also influenced by someone whom he knew, Carl Schmitt was very controversial in German legal theories and political theories. Controversial because for a while he supported the Nazis, but Schmitt famously defined politics as a struggle between friend and enemy. And Strauss wrote a review of Schmitt's short book, The Concept of the Political, that Schmitt admired. And Strauss said really that Schmitt hadn't carried the criticism of liberalism far enough, and that really he hadn't realized the importance of philosophical life, but he was sympathetic to Schmitt in stressing the importance of power. And the reason this is important, the stress on important for understanding neoconservatives, according to Bradley Thompson, is that war provides one means that people can develop virtue. For example, in war, people can become, have an opportunity to display courage, and people are willing to sacrifice in war. And this is, of course, the key thing Thompson really doesn't like, because remember, the objectivists think that altruism is really the source of all evil in ethics. But according to Strauss, instead of being interested in just individual acquisition, material gain, people in a virtuous people need to sacrifice for the state. In war, they're able to do this. So this is really the key to Thompson's interpretation of neoconservative foreign policy, that the neocons promote war in order to have an opportunity to mold the public. And so that's what we'll be discussing next week when we talk about neoconservative foreign policy. Okay, so I think I'll stop there, and the rest of the time we can have for questions and discussion objections. And I see Charles has put up something here. He says, the elite is neat, the masses are asses. What is an ass for the dumb beast of burden who labors for the elite? Neoconservatism in a nutshell. Yes, this is very much the way Bradley Thompson is viewing the neoconservative interpretation based on the way he looks at Leo Strauss. I'll tell you, but there's a question here, I was just going to tell a story. Now, Doug says, were the neocons influential in the Reagan and or Bush 41 administration? Yes, they were. I mean, we can see people like Seth Cropsey, who was, I think, in the Defense Department, the son of Joseph Cropsey at the University of Chicago, who was Leo Strauss's literary executor, and Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle were around, and they were influenced Dick Cheney, who was around in those years. So the neocons were around, and people took the views of Crystal very seriously. Reagan, I think, it was interested in that. Because I'm not. A.O. Spencer, do you believe a great society program contributed to the decline of Negro families? Well, that was famously, I think, Moynihan, Daniel Moynihan argued that. It seems like there's a good deal to be said in favor of that view, that it did, you know, there had been kind of a trend. Charles Murray had a book on the war on poverty where he argued that. I think if you look at Charles Murray's book, you'll get some good material in that. Now, Andy says, why did Reagan switch parties from Democrat to Republican? By the same reason as Irving Kristol. Reagan had been really attracted to the Goldwater movement and Kristol had not been supportive of Goldwater. But I remember Reagan was giving sort of promotional speeches for the General Electric Company, and he was more associated with, he just became attracted to kind of a National Review style conservatism. Now, while you're thinking of another question, I'll just tell you kind of a funny story. I was talking again to my friend James Sadowski, the Jesuit libertarian philosopher, and I said to him, I was telling him about this course, I said, some people think that the neoconservatives got us involved in the war in Iraq. Now, what was his objection to that statement? And this is kind of the funny part. It's not an objection to the claim that neoconservatives influenced American foreign policy. It's an objection to the wording of the statement, the neoconservatives got us involved in the war in Iraq. Now, this is a rather tricky one, and I like trick questions. What would you say, what would be an objection to saying the neoconservatives got us involved in the war in Iraq? It's kind of a philosophical style objection, a very kind of minor point, kind of a tricky little point that Sadowski likes. Can anybody think of something? Anybody have any suggestions? Well, according to Sadowski, if you say the neocons, we're involved until the neocons got us there. I think you're close. You see, if you say that, yeah, you're basically on the right. Yes, I think you're basically got us. If you say got us involved in the war in Iraq, that suggests there was a war in Iraq to get involved in. But there wasn't a war until the neocons helped start one. So he's objecting. If you say the neocons got us involved in the war in Iraq, that would be something like saying the U.S. got involved in World War One. World War One was going on already. Ah, yes, Jeff. Well, then you're right. You're thinking along Sadowski's line. You're entirely right. Go to the head of the class. You've done well. Okay, but I mean, that's a typical Sadowski stuff. Oh, you took my logic class twice. Well, that's very kind of you. Maybe if I'd taken my class twice, I would have gotten that point, too. Yeah, Sadowski is a very good one to read. And here's a question. Alex, could you describe more of your thoughts on Peikoff's Yanis parallel, the influence of Kantian ideas in the rise of the Nazis? Well, there's a very funny story there. See, in 1982, Ralph Raichel asked me to review the book for Inquiry magazine. He was the book editor. I wrote a very negative review of the book, we got into enormous trouble with the Randys. Now, basically, what Pico said is something like, Kant denied that we have knowledge of objective reality. Kant basically said, the mind imposes certain categories on reality. So when we make a claim to knowledge, we're not talking about the world as it is in itself. We're just talking about our own mental constructs. So Peikoff thinks that way of looking at the knowledge became very influential, and that led to the Nazis eventually, because Nazism is really based on refusal to think logically about the world and to accept reality and the requirements of reality. It's more that we can impose, but just because of our emotions D.H. Lawrence's phrase, think with the blood, you know, we're just thinking in a completely emotional manner. We're just not using reason and science to discover the world. He thinks that had Kantian origin. Now, I thought he misread Kant, and he hadn't shown any case that Kant's ideas were that influential on political developments that the Nazis, as he suggests. And I also thought there were a great many historical errors in the book. But I mean, it's certainly one you should read for yourself if you're interested in that subject. I mean, I tended not to, maybe I was too harsh on the book, although I still don't like it all that much. Let's see, there's one here. A.L. Spence, Rothbard and Swanside, the old right, mentioned most Democratic Republican party in the early 50s, were against the ground war in Southeast Asia. What changed their minds, especially LBJ? Well, of course, LBJ, you see, really inherited somewhat of a commitment to the war from Kennedy. And I think he was influenced first by various security advisors like Walt Whitman Rostow and Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara and National Security Advisor like George Bundy, who told him, they thought, well, we got kind of more kind of very way of looking at things. We have these very high-powered intellectuals who developed strategic analyses that show we can win the war. And they thought they'd be able to be successful. Now, one thing LBJ, I think, that influenced him, he was very much a New Deal Democrat. And he thought, well, maybe we could kind of establish a great society programs in South Vietnam. We can put in all these programs of agricultural redevelopment and win the people over. So he thought, really, you could kind of have a New Deal applied to Southeast Asia. But then, after a while, he realized things weren't going so well, but he thought it would really create a big crisis if he just pulled out. This would be very bad politically for him, because you'd have to admit he made a big mistake, so he just thought he'd kind of hang in there. But I mean, I think he tended to become very skeptical himself of whether the war would be successful. Now, Andrew says, wasn't one of the first neocon political victories to get William Bennett into Reagan National Endowment for Humanities instead of Mel Bradford? That's a very interesting question, because, you know, Mel Bradford was a very good friend of mine, so I knew some of the stories from him. Now, Mel was a rather kind of very unusual person. He was about 6'5", 350 pounds, and had a very strong Southern accent. So what happened was the neocons wanted their own candidate, Bennett, instead of Bradford. So they started a campaign against Bradford based on the fact that Bradford had been very critical of Lincoln. And they just started publishing all sorts of articles attacking him. And he was wondering, well, why should your interpretation of something that happened in the Civil War be a determining factor in whether we get some national government? The neocons could be quite very tough in their attacks. Remember, they'd grown up in, you know, involving New York labor union politics, involving infighting when they were Trotskyites and all these various communist factions. So they were used to very rough tactics, and so they were able to get there. Started a campaign against Bradford, you're quite right. Now, Hale Spencer, I just keep recalling Eisenhower's wanting to beware of the industrial military company. Yes, that's right, that was a famous speech Eisenhower gave at the end of his presidency. I think you're right, that's come to pass. Robert Higgs, the historian, has written a lot on the military-industrial complex, and so that's a very good... What do I do now? I just knocked the chat thing off here. What do I do now? Hello, Danny. I just got off. How do I get back on the chat here? I just knocked it off. Oh, wait. Let me go to chat again. Oh, yeah. Okay, I'm back. Never mind. Oh, Andrew, I didn't know you knew. Oh, yeah. Yes. I met Mel Bradford. In 1989, there was a conference at the Rockford Institute. I got to know him. I used to call him up a lot, and we would talk over various things. It turned out we both had the same favorite professional wrestler, Lou Ferris. And he used to laugh at some of my jokes, I'm afraid. But he was a very good literary critic. And great authority on William Faulkner, and he wrote on the Southern tradition. He'd been a student of Donald Davidson, who was one of the great Southern agrarians. He was a very, very learned person. I thought very highly of Mel Bradford. Okay, well, we still have about 15 minutes left. We have plenty of time for more. Is there a particular book you would recommend by Robert Higgs on the military-industrial complex? Well, I think anything by Higgs is really good. I don't think there's one in particular I recommend, but anything by him, I think you should get. You know, I reviewed several of them, so you can. But he discusses that topic very frequently. I think he has an essay specifically on Eisenhower's speech. Now, Charles says that they're going to put into the discussion since he knew Strauss and Schmidt. I knew Erich Vogelin also, as a matter of fact, and he really, I don't think he was not particularly sympathetic to the neoconservatives. He wasn't, he viewed Strauss as somewhat of a rival. He had correspondence with him, but Vogelin tended, I think, to Vogelin tended not to write on policy issues very much, but he did have, as you say, he had correspondence with Strauss. One of the things they did, they both got together to make sure Karl Popper didn't get a position at the University of Chicago. And I think Strauss and Vogelin reviewed each other's books, but I don't think Vogelin had much, didn't write too much on foreign policy. Vogelin did tend to favor kind of he supported the Cold War to some extent. Talks in New Science and Politics about a power vacuum in Europe, but he was more, he tended not to get involved in policy views. He tended more in his interpretation of Plato, tended to quote more like the religious aspects of Plato. I think Strauss tends to view everybody, all the great political philosophers, as really secret atheists, but Vogelin was very much against that. He would not have agreed with that. Let's see here, something else. Matthew says, you mentioned a number of times in the lecture that Trotsky was influential to a number of conservative neocons. Are there a certain aspect of Trotsky is that they were particularly influenced by? Well, I think one thing that neocons, especially the later ones, were influenced by, which I see, is Trotsky had the idea of spreading revolution throughout the world. And as we'll see in the next lecture, there's some neocons who say, well, we have to have a democratic revolution all over the world. So say one thing that was very influential in an argument for the Iraq War was, well, we can really establish a democracy in the Mideast, and if we do that, if we establish democracies in all these Middle East countries, and this will be a great benefit to the U.S. So the idea of kind of a worldwide democratic revolution has some parallels with the Trotskyist notion of world revolution. We can see, say, with the National Review conservatives like Burnham, you know, again, you have, he's become an anti-communist, but he still has a notion that there's a world struggle going on, sort of the notion that, say, a country should just mind its own business is one that would be alien both to Trotsky and to the neocons and also the National Review people. So I think that would be one point of similarity there. Now, one thing, since someone has mentioned, just to connect two of the questions, you might be interested, if you're interested in Vogelin, that Mel Bradford knew Vogelin. They got along very well. And now, here's another question. Could you draw us a family tree or fashion tree that starts with Trotsky and ends with today's neocon? That would be helpful to see in the next class. Well, I can think about it. I'm not very good at drawing, but you know, I'll certainly bear that one in mind. Oh, sorry, I missed that question before. That was, I should have taken that before. Let's see, did I miss anything else? Jeff says, you know, the neocons have much familiarity with Austrian economics. You know, Jonah Goldberg has read any Rothbard, for example. Well, I think he has some familiarity with, I think he cites Rothbard, I think, in his book on liberal fascism. You see, Jonah Goldberg, I believe, is friends with Steve Horowitz, who's an Austrian economist, he would have some knowledge of Austrian economics from Horowitz. I think Horowitz read some of Goldberg's book. He didn't remove any of the historical mistakes in the book that I was unkind enough to point out, but I think that would be one connection he had with, he would have some connection with the Austrians through that. Just as I know that Ann Coulter mentioned me and George Reese in one of her. Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. I don't know Ann Coulter. I know George Reese quite well, but I didn't know that she mentioned George Reese. Yes, he's a very nice person, George Reese. Let's see, here's something. Andrew says, given the last point you said about war promoting public virtue, I wonder if the neocons think it's working. I think that's an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, they might say, I think they would think we need to have a government that's conducting the war more directly promoting public virtue. They tend to be quite critical of Obama as really not in line with their thinking, but I think they'd say, well, if we really had a good war going, then they like World War II. They think this was really, people really had the right idea of kind of a national spirit of unity among the people. They like to recreate that, but I think it's certainly an objection to their view that we don't have this sense of unity in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. I think the neocons would just say, well, that shows we're not doing things in the right way. Well, here's your question. Jeff, why is the group called the neocons not being persuaded by Moody's and Rothbard in you? Well, I think when they read Moody's and Rothbard, I'm sure they never paid attention to anything I said, but when they read Moody's and Rothbard, I think they'd say Moody's and Rothbard are really using kind of outdated notions of individualism that have been really, if you had a true philosophical understanding of things, you would realize it's just kind of a very superficial view. So I think they would they would just say this is the reason not, but unrealistic and also philosophically shallow, I suspect. I think that's what I mean, Kristol thought, well, Mises, I think he thinks Hayek in particular has raised some good criticisms of socialism, but he's gone too far in his support for capitalism. They just don't view it that way. And of course, the neocons, in contrast to Mises and Rothbard, are not economic theorists. I think they tend to think they know something about economics, but they really don't. I don't think they should listen to Mises and Rothbard, but unfortunately they don't. Well, I guess we're about out of time now. If anybody has anything else, I guess we'll see you next week then for another lecture on the neocons. So thanks everybody. Thanks for coming for the lecture. Hope to see you again. Bye everybody.